Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Political Party Podcast. This one features Ken Clark, one of the most dominant and prominent political figures of my life, a man who's been an MP for 49 years. He's the father of the House, one of the longest serving cabinet ministers in history, Chancellor, Health Secretary, Home Secretary, amongst so many others, and now finds himself, I mean, he's a man who's permanently having renaissances. But he finds himself at the moment in a position where, once again, people are talking about him potentially becoming Prime Minister. We get his view on that. It's probably what you would guess from someone with the sense of humour that he possesses. But also, I spoke to him on the day, so it's the day after the Supreme Court ruling against Boris Johnson, and the evening that Boris Johnson had just addressed the House of Commons to respond to it. A highly controversial session of Parliament. So you are talking to someone who's been at the centre of things for so long at the moment that it's all happening, as well as obviously wanting to get his view of a broader view of history, his experience serving in the Thatcher and Major governments particularly, a bit of his experience in the Cameron government. And of course, as two fans of Nottingham Forest, a brief chat about Brian Clough, but I slightly indulged myself there. But he is exactly as you would expect him to be. Really funny, so wise, and just handles it all with such good nature that it was reassuring speaking to him. I mean, also deeply worrying because he's very honest about the problems he thinks we face. But he has a natural optimism and cheeriness that you think, well, if he's still smiling, maybe we'll all be okay. But I don't want to ruin any of it. It was, oh, man. I love every guest who comes on, but there are certain guests. It was the same with Michael Heseltine, where, and it's not just that they've maybe been around a bit longer, but the ones that have really been at the top end for so long. And maybe it's just about when you're growing up, but obviously as a child, Ken Clark's one of the first politicians I remember, and he was always in a senior position. He was, you know, stood for the Conservative leadership three times, and that was when they were in opposition. When he was in government, he was one of the most powerful people in the country, and even though I was never a Conservative, I always liked him. Now, maybe that's because he was a Nottingham MP. Maybe that's because he's a Forest fan. I think it's more that he's just a really likeable bloke. And it's really interesting to hear what his politics are and where they come from. Anyway, I'm just waffling on. Don't forget, you can email the show, politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. And also, yes, I'm doing two London shows of Brexit Pursued by a Bear. One on the 6th of October at the wonderful South Bank Centre. And we're at the 12th of October at the wonderful King's Place. And you can find ticket links to both of those in the show notes. And also the Christmas Party Special is now on sale. It's on the 18th of December at the Bloomsbury Theatre this year. And MP4 are confirmed. And I have a very lovely surprise to be able to announce as soon as possible for that show. So, yes, the ticket links to all those shows are in the show notes, however you watch or consume this. So I am going to shut up for now and leave you in the hands of Ken Clark.
Thank you very much. Good evening. Welcome to the show. Quiet week. Holy fuck. That's most of I never knew that the end of the world would be so entertaining. I mean, I don't know how people... I have to say, obviously hating and loving it in equal measure. Give me a cheer if you've been to the political party before. Whee! And welcome back, regulars. Give me a cheer if this is your first time. Whee! Excellent. Welcome, newcomers. Tonight we have a man... I mean, my God, of all the nights to be talking to... Oh, man. Oh, my God. Potentially our next Prime Minister. This is so exciting. Oh, my God. Anyway, I mean, it's obviously what is going on is awful, but it's great television as well. Really, really brilliant. So it turns out that Boris Johnson lied to the Queen. I mean, I don't think we can rule out the fact he might have tried to shag her. He did bow very low. Too rude at the start, fair dues. If you're a follower of the Church of England, of course, the Queen is God's representative on earth. I mean, this is basically lied to God. Don't rule him out sat there in limbo going, "Are you? Come on, I know I do accept the judgment of St. Peter, but I know I do disagree. I think if Satan is open to doing a deal, then we should do that before October the 31st. He's also had to answer questions, and hasn't answered questions yet, about his relationship with a pole dancing model called Jennifer Arcuri, who received thousands of pounds in public money after he started hanging around with her as Mayor of London. Apparently he was nipping around to her East London flat whilst Mayor for what she has described as technology lessons. Explains why his hair was always so ruffled, I suppose. He was at the UN as well. Yes, I mean, what was incredible was he decided to be in New York on the day that he knew the Supreme Court were going to return their judgment. So it looked bad to be out of the country anyway. He's at the UN and behaves like nothing is going on. Nothing bad is going on. He delivers his speech, I don't know if anyone saw it, where he says, he starts talking about artificial intelligence. So we need to, as a planet, I've come to a view on what AI, will AI bring opportunities? Will it bring robots that can care for and wash our elderly? Or will it send pink-eyed Terminators back from the future to obliterate the human race? Which one do you think it is? Fuck, the Terminator's got pink eye. I mean, that's a medical problem anyway. Second, I mean, this is a prime minister. Anyway, even without the Supreme Court judgment, that goes to the UN, his first speech to the UN, and that's the shit he's coming out with. We put him in the canon of some of our prime ministers. Gladstone, my mission is to pacify Ireland. Churchill, never before in the field of human conflict has so much been owed to so many by so few. Boris Johnson, and what if the future sends back sexy pole dancing robots to seduce married blonde British men? I learned about it in some technology lessons. Yeah. I mean, this is a bloke. I mean, this is what is incredible, obviously, about the situation we're now in. It's about that on all sides it's chaos. And Boris Johnson isn't just been found to have broken the law in the Supreme Court. This man is a security risk. MI6 think our own Prime Minister is a security risk because, in their view, he's been such a shagger and will continue to be. This leaves him open to blackmail by a hostile foreign power. Now, all I would say is what MI6 have completely underestimated is this. How do you blackmail a man with no shame? What are the Russians going to say to him? Give us 30 billion quid or we destroy your reputation. Yeah, I'm way ahead of you. Turns out it's part of the attraction, so he's a security risk, though. It's a security risk to each and every single one of us as British citizens should we go on holiday. Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe can tell you that. She'd been in prison for 2 years in Iran because when he was foreign secretary, he said the one thing he was told not to say. Line one of her defence, she worked for Thomson Reuters, was that I was in Iran, I was on holiday, I was at no point teaching journalists. And as foreign secretary, he got involved. He said, the Iranians must release Nazanin. All she was doing was teaching journalists. Mate, that was the one thing you were told not to say. Never call that bloke as a character witness. No. I can assure the court, by the way, it's a pleasure to be back. I can assure the court that Mr. Ford would never have punched this man in the face. If anything, he wouldn't have stopped. He possesses a volcanic vampiric rage. And had he punched this man in the face, you'd almost certainly be dead. Yeah, if anything, you made the situation worse, mate. I mean, think about the man we've now got as our Prime Minister's security risk to himself, to us collectively, as individuals. I mean, with Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, one of two things has happened. Either the man who's now our Prime Minister wrongly identified a British civilian as being a spy and cost her a liberty, or the man who's now Prime Minister blew the cover of a British spy. Now, if our own Prime Minister is going to start uncovering our operatives abroad, the Bond films are going to be very different under Boris. They're going to be short films. Ding, 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 ding. Bond! Sorry, your Prime Minister here. I gave your location to the Iranians. You will be executed within the next 30 seconds. I'm sorry. But... What the fuck? 30 seconds and I'm dead. What the hell is going on? What about the Russian girl I've got back at the hotel? Yeah, too late. I've already shagged her. Oh, my word. He's going to deliver a no-deal Brexit. Apart from whatever happens next, no-deal Brexit is currently the most likely outcome. That's what the bookings are saying this week. No-deal Brexit is the most likely outcome. And you've got all these people out there, a lot of Tory MPs, promoting a no-deal Brexit that they don't understand. Andrea Jenkins was on Politics Live the other week. She said, look, if we leave without a deal, we can trade with the EU on WTO rules like everybody else does. And Jo Coburn said, all right, who else does? And she went, well... I have to look further into that, won't I? Yes, you will, Andrea. You should look further into it first before you try to convince the rest of us of it. The logic of it. Officer, officer, arrest this man. He's a murderer. Is he? Well, I don't fucking know, do I? Do your job, mate. I've got too much on as it is. I mean, by the way, five countries trade with the EU on WTO rules. They are Kazakhstan, North Korea, Russia, Cuba, and Venezuela. So that's Corbyn on board. And the backstop, it doesn't matter whether we've got a deal or without a deal. The big problem that they still haven't squared, and they're sending all these non-papers over to the EU, is about the backstop. Is what they want is to be able to get out of the backstop, have a time limit or whatever it is. Whether we leave with a deal or without a deal, no deal or not, the government has created a list of three priorities around the backstop that Boris Johnson agrees with as much as Theresa May did, that cannot be delivered. It's one of the most incredible lists ever drawn up in history, because each demand on the list immediately contradicts the one before it. It's absolutely undeliverable. The first demand is this. We are definitely leaving the single market and the customs union. Fine. That involves a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic. The second demand. No hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic. Right, okay. The effect of that is that Northern Ireland stays in a different customs arrangement with the Republic. The final demand. Northern Ireland cannot stay in a separate customs arrangement with the Republic. Well, I can't deliver that. You fucked it. I'm not saying, right, I want you to get me a pet. It must bark, have feathers, and be a cat. Look, that's impossible. I can do one of those bumps with staples and glue, two of those things. And the way they talk about it, making it so easy. Just the other week, on the anniversary of Apollo 11, where boys are like, if we can get, by the way, yeah, men from Earth, I put them on the moon. And get them back onto get them back into, yeah, if we can put men on the moon and get them back, then surely we can find a solution to the Northern Ireland backstop. Now those two challenges aren't in any way related. There's no legacy technology from the moon landings that will help you solve an administrative political problem on the island. There's not anything. He might as well have got up and said, oh, you know, come on. If the Druids could build Stonehenge, I should be able to lick my own elbow. No. One doesn't affect the other at all. And now he's spending 100 million quid. You may have seen the billboards and the leaflets already. 100 million pounds promoting a no-deal Brexit to the British public to try and get us ready for October the 31st. Now, you'll have seen the ad campaign. It doesn't contain any pertinent facts, because the facts about a no-deal Brexit are awful. The Office of Budget Responsibility says in the event of a no deal, we enter a minimum 1 year recession. The Bank of England says in the event of no deal, unemployment could double and hit 2.6 million people. Just in terms of some of the stuff that's been leaked under Operation Yellowhammer, multiple motorways on the south of England will be commandeered by the army and turned into lorry parks. The M20 and the M26, I think, have already been earmarked to become lorry parks. Now, an extra 2 minute border check at the border adds 7 miles to motorway tailbacks. 4 minutes, 14 miles to motorway tailbacks. 6 minutes, lots of miles to motorway tailbacks. The whole of the south of England is going to be gridlocked if we leave without a deal on October the 31st. Imagine the traffic reports in a no-deal Brexit Britain. Traffic still non-moving northbound and southbound on the M1, M5, M8, M20, M25 and M26. Some of those tailbacks should start to clear within the next 4 to 5 years. We are getting some reports that truckers at the front of that queue have been waiting 3 years, have already started to drink their own urine, so no change there. Don't worry. You can win a day's supply of fresh drinking water. It's all part of our no-meal, no-deal giveaway. And don't forget that just-in-time re-release for this Christmas, just to keep you company on some of those long, long tailbacks, he's reworded it and re-released it. It's Chris Rea, and I'm stuck in traffic drinking my own piss for Christmas. Some of the other effects of a no-deal Brexit. We're going to lose legal protection from dangerous electrical products if we leave without a deal. We weren't told this in the referendum. Going to Argos now isn't so much to furnish your flat, it's a cry for help. Could be buying exploded toasters. The whole thing's a nightmare. Medicine. We import 37 million packs of medicine from the EU every month. In the event of a no deal, there is the potential that none of that gets through. GPs already telling their patients to give them 5 to 12 months' notice for any medication they might need. Now, given that most of us don't know when we're going to get ill, that's just a shot in the dark. Yeah, hello, doctor. Yeah, could you get me some stuff in for September next year, please? Yeah, just some morphine, some gauze, and about 4 pints of A-negative blood. Yeah, I just got a feeling I'm going to get a kick in. Why? I'm Jewish and I'm going to the Labour Party conference. More of that on the way. Brace yourself. Some of the other implications are incredible. Infidelity is going to increase by 35%. It's true. I read it in the Sunday Express. Come to a website called Illicit Encounters. During a recession, people are more likely to cheat on their husbands and wives, and they reckon a no-deal Brexit will trigger the worst recession in living memory, and 35% of people are going to start cheating on each other. Now, as a proportion of tonight's audience, that's probably everyone in this section here. People who, by the way, make me feel sick. Another issue we're going to have, I mean, obviously the Prime Minister is included in these stats, he accounts for about 12% of that infidelity. The other issue we have, we're going to run out of sperm. Not because of that, because UK sperm banks are over-reliant on foreign donations. We receive 3,000 donations from Denmark alone every year. Now, I don't know how many individuals that is. Could just be one guy churning it out. Some Viking. Anyway. The UK, the chief executive of the UK Sperm Bank Association said in the event of a no-deal Brexit, sperm may not be able to pass through the border. Now, that's kind of what sperm does. But he also said, in the event of a no-deal Brexit, we will be left with no alternative but to produce our own. That's right, no longer a filthy habit. It is your patriotic duty. I mean, that is not a vision of Britain we were sold during the referendum. This could be our lives on November the 1st this year. Sat at home ill because we can't get any medication. You can't drive anywhere because everywhere's a lorry park. Your wife's cheating on you with some trucker of the lay-by of the N26. You're sat at home going blind because you've been wanking into exploding toasters. Never put that on the side of a fucking bus, did they? I mean, Labour's position. I mean, this is part of the problem. Part of the reason why the Tories could get away with delivering a no-deal Brexit, potentially, is because Labour in a real state. In Labour's conference this week, I don't know if you saw Jeremy Corbyn's speech yesterday. I mean, it was a speech he didn't write. It was a speech he barely read aloud. He was reading it out of one eye. I mean, the intonation of it, I don't know if you saw any of it live. It was like watching Ron Burgundy deliver... We will deliver a referendum? It was like you put the whole thing through Google Translate. We will nationalise the energy industry and I would like a taxi to the old town. Now, he said something else in his speech that I thought was hilarious. And he said this line with particular passion. He said, no one should be forced to work beyond the age of 75. Which at the age of 70 is basically a coded cry for help. He really looked at John McDonnell when he said it. Keir Starmer gave an interview, friend of the show. Keir Starmer gave an interview afterwards where he said he had mixed feelings about Jeremy's speech, which is fair, isn't it? Because on the one hand, it was bad. On the other hand, it was shit. So I think we all had mixed feelings about it. Labour's Brexit position still hasn't changed. They've moved the policy on a bit, the principle of it, and they're amazed this hasn't worked as a piece of manipulation. And this was genuinely their plan and still is. And this is their whole sort of plan to win the next general election. What they're going to do, they're going to tell Leave voters what they want to hear. And at the same time, they're going to tell Remain voters what they want to hear. And then everyone is going to vote Labour. What they've underestimated is this. The Leave voters could hear what they were saying to the Remain voters. And the Remain voters could hear what they were saying to the Leave voters. It wasn't so much robbing Peter to pay Paul, as robbing Peter and robbing Paul, then calling them both agents of Israel. I mean, think about where Corbyn is. His acolytes have been on social media this week saying he's now in the centre ground. Corbyn's now at the centre ground. Jeremy Corbyn is a man who's been allergic to the centre ground his whole life. He would be offended if you ever called him a centrist. And yet, for the first time in his entire existence, he's tried to find the centre ground and he picks the only issue in human history that does not have a centre ground. There's no centre ground on Brexit. It's binary. You're either in or you're out. There are no semi-Brexiteers out there. No one out there going, can we just leave Belgium? Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm now going to prorogue this event until 20 minutes' time, where you can all, I mean, try and drink as much as Shami Chakrabarty did. If you haven't seen the video, go on Twitter. Oh, shit-faced. So maybe don't get as drunk. But in the break, if you can get on the Wi-Fi, look at it. Amazing. Anyway, I obviously in the second half, am about to interview someone that I've wanted to interview for a very long time. And was meant to be on the show earlier in the year. The timing of it could not be better. And he is on the brink, genuinely on the brink of being our next Prime Minister. So this is absolutely thrilling. I'm not sure whether he agrees with that or not, but I shall find out in the second half. For now, as always, you've been such a wonderful crowd. Welcome back to this new series of The Political Party. I shall see you in 20 minutes. For now, I've been Matt Ford. Well, thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight we have a true legend of British politics, the father of the House, a man who has served in the House of Commons since 1970. Someone who's, absolutely, wow indeed, one of the longest serving cabinet ministers in the entirety of British history. A true legend of politics, someone who has admirers on all sides of the divide, has always been the case, and I'm sure even more so now. Who knows what is going to happen in the next few days, but we might be talking to our next Prime Minister. Please welcome Ken Clark!
Yeah. There we are. I've made it.
If you go that side, sorry.
Go that side, right. You want me on your left, could you?
Maybe for the only time tonight. So, obviously, we're recording this for a podcast, so people may be listening to this in the next 2 or 3 days. So
good luck to them.
Just want to be—I want to address you in the correct way, Prime Minister. So, I mean,
makes me nostalgic. People used to say that seriously, you know, years ago.
I mean, do you feel that? Obviously, you had ambitions to be Prime Minister at least 3 times. In 97, 01 and 2005. I mean, do you feel that actually this is tantalisingly close now, the possibility?
No, I don't. I went away on holiday, deliberately shut myself off. I was in Norway from all kind of news, got off a plane when I flew back from Bergen, and I tried to pick up a British newspaper, and Joe Swinson had set off. I saw the story was that I was about to be the next Prime Minister but two, and I thought, good grief, this takes me back a few years, you know, and all that. And the trouble is, you know, as in modern politics, everybody's more interested in personalities than they are about all these complicated issues. It's a bit of a comic footnote, actually. A most bizarre series of events have to take place to produce a government of national unity and me or Harriet Harman heading it up and all the rest of it. And actually, of all the subjects we should be discussing, it's about the most ridiculous. So it doesn't matter a tuppenny damn who leads a government of national unity. What matters is, does anybody have a clue what this government of national unity are all going to agree to do? So I thought it was a rather nice reintroduction to get back into the fray and all that. But no, I haven't come here to make my bid. I've done that, been there. No.
You talk about a whole series of ludicrous events having to take place, but at the moment they are, so...
Absolutely. Yeah. You think it can't get any sillier, and every day you're surprised that some further bizarre turn has taken place. I quite agree.
So what is your analysis and your reaction to the Supreme Court judgment this week?
I was surprised, first of all. I'm a very out-of-date lawyer, but I've been Lord Chancellor not too long ago. That was my last job but one. So I am a lawyer, and all the lawyers who are more up-to-date and, you know, than me all agree with me that it's highly unlikely that the Supreme Court would come to this decision. Brenda Hale, a great fan of, she's a very nice woman, but I thought she and her colleagues would... they just would not take the step of getting into such a politically charged area, their bailout. What I hoped was they'd find reluctantly for the government, and then they'd come out with what a lawyer calls obiter dicta, all kinds of pronouncements about how, in a properly run country, these things should happen, and just to try and lay down a marker for future, you see. So that was what I thought would happen. So when I never thought they'd be unanimous. So I was startled by the result. So that's my first earnest, out-of-date lawyer's approach to it. But every other lawyer I know, I met one of the people who, pardon me, Dave, one of the barristers who acted for one of the people bringing the case. He didn't act for Gina, but anyway, I won't go further than that. And I discussed it with him earlier on when I wished him the best of luck. And I remembered I'd said to him, you know, I don't think you've got many feathers to fly with, really, but, you know, good luck and all that. And I think he was a little startled to find he'd won. But it's a very good job he has. I mean, I would defend it because I'm a great defender of an unwritten constitution. I would say it's a good thing. But it depends on conventions, all kinds of accepted ways of doing things, what British governments will do and what they won't do. And there's a kind of very British kind of good chap rule, you know, that runs through the whole thing. Well, all these weird political campaigning characters that Boris has surrounded himself with have no time for Parliament. They don't know anything about government or anything of that kind. And, you know, once they're told, well, these are only conventions. Oh, damn that. We'll tear those up. You know, we were going to have a presidential system with no checks and balances. No Parliament, no courts, you know, just a wise president who will occasionally tell the cabinet what he's just done. I'm being converted to a written constitution. And the Supreme Court has stepped in, and obviously they were persuaded, you know, this is impossible. And I only defended it today. I got up today. The reaction of everybody to the judgment depends on whether they're a remainer or a leaver, which is stupid, because as Baroness Hale said, that's the one thing they weren't deciding, and I believe that's obviously the case. But the truth is, if future governments had built on this, I might have enjoyed listening to the right wing of the Conservative Party going utterly berserk as Jeremy Corbyn, if he ever gets into government, which I don't think he ever will, but if they ever got into government, you know, suddenly started deciding to send Parliament away because he hadn't got a majority for some of his more outrageous things. I mean, the right wing of the Conservative Party would go absolutely loony if a Labour government ever tried to send Parliament away simply because the majority in Parliament disagreed with their main policy. It was outrageous. And it would have had to be corrected, or it could have got completely out of hand. So it's a good thing. It's a very good thing. Sorry to give you. I always give long answers.
Oh, no, it's good. Very good. What do you make of the reactions, particularly in Parliament today, of the Attorney General Geoffrey Cox and the Prime Minister Boris Johnson?
I miss Boris. I decided to have a break. I've sat in the chamber most of the afternoon. I particularly went in for the serious statement, which was on Iran. But nobody's taking notice of that. But I was there for Geoffrey, and I enjoyed it enormously. It was great. Some people were enraged by it, but it's amazing, you know. It's pre-Rumpel. It's a fantastic style. Actually, he's a good lawyer. There was a recent Lord Chancellor. Unlike some other politicians into politics, he said all the right things about the court and the law, and what the judgment was about, what it wasn't, and all that. But he has this marvellous 19th century, amazing style. And then he decided to get a bit political, which he's allowed to. And by that time, it was really arms failing, you know, rolling tones, all the rest of it. Well, rather depends on one's temperament. I thought this was hilarious. But other people were deeply, deeply shocked. But, so I left that. Boris, I kept waiting for Boris. The whole thing's gone on all afternoon, and I was in for quite a lot of it. And because I was coming here, I finally decided, well, is Boris going to say anything new? And I thought, highly unlikely. Jamie from my office has been trying to keep in touch with it all because he's come here with me, but he was trying to keep me up to date. As far as I can see, he's just said nothing new. He just ranted on about how he was only proroguing the House because he'd had a sudden thought. He had lots of policies to put in the Queen's speech and all this, and then he started just carrying on about the joys of Brexit. Jeremy Corbyn certainly seems to have said nothing new that he hasn't said umpteen times before. So I'm probably better off here.
A You once said it would be ludicrous to have Boris Johnson as Prime Minister.
Yeah, no, you're the first person to look that up. There was this... there was this occasion when I was chatting with my old friend Malcolm Rifkin, when really for two old sweats we should have had more sense. The idea you can sit in the corner of a television studio when you've just done a thing and be absolutely confident you can just have a chat together. And, you know, they put a camera and a mic on us, and everybody reported me. He was asking my opinions of all the candidates. And I, rather notoriously, he asked me about Theresa May, and I said, well, she's a bloody difficult woman. Although, to be fair, I went on to say, but you and I work for Margaret Thatcher, for God's sake. So that's probably why I thought I was probably going to vote for her. He asked me about Boris Johnson, and I... People have pointed out to me, people who remember seeing, that I did actually say, well, it's just ridiculous to think of Boris Johnson as Prime Minister. And nobody's quoted it back at me until you have this evening. But I haven't changed my mind.
What really strikes me, I suppose, and many others watching it, is that, you know, your whole life you get used to liking some Prime Ministers more than others. And watching politicians that you didn't vote for, but saying, oh, well, actually, John Major seems like a really decent person.
Yeah.
Or Ken Clark seems like a really decent person. Boris Johnson, I suppose, in a way, because of Leave Remain, is able to reach into some Labour heartlands like Stoke and places like that and maybe mobilise people in a way that previous Conservative Prime Ministers might not have been able to. But do you think he can command that genuine cross-party, cross-country respect in the way that someone like John Major
would? Well, let me make it clear. I just made an unkind remark about Boris as Prime Minister. It's not personal. He's good fun as company. I've never fallen out with anybody in my life just because I politically disagree with him, and I don't always disagree with him. His private life, which you had fun with, I take the view it was nothing to do with me, frankly, so I couldn't care less about that. So I haven't fallen out with him personally, but the strategy he's following is as you describe, and he appears utterly set in electoral terms on winning the white working class Brexit vote in the North and North Midlands, and seems content to sacrifice the home county's younger Liberal vote in the South. And so everything is pitched at ousting Farage in all these Labour seats in the North, some which are very vulnerable, because the left behind industrial towns are protesting against the establishment, in part by being overwhelmingly Leave. And so he's trying to outdo Farage. The whole Parliament versus the people thing is taken straight from Brexit Party campaigning of 6 months ago and literature. Seriously, I think it's a rather cynical and shallow approach, because the politics of Boris Johnson, insofar as he's got any politics on any subject, do not match the inhabitants of Stoke-on-Trent and Barnsley and Hartlepool and so on. And it's already well saying you give up Guildford because you're going to get Bishop Auckland and all this. But actually, I may be wishful thinking, it's a gamble that isn't going to come off. I think Mr. Farage, who's the most successful Prime Minister of my generation, not Prime Minister, but politician, he succeeded in probably completely changing the role of Britain in the world. But he's a good runner. The idea that, you know, he's going to get all these Brexit votes and sweep the north of England and take the rest of it, he'll take some. He's won Mansfield in my county. And other unlikely places. My first time ever. I used to fight Mansfield, and very proud to keep the majority below 20,000 against me. but he's not going to repeat that across the line. I think Nigel Farage will beat him. And he won't get an electoral pact with Farage. As you know, Farage is quite clear that it's all right, he'll have a pact, so long as he's given a clear run at 60 to 80 seats in the North and the Midlands. And Farage, if there was a pact, you know, has a good chance of winning quite a lot of those. But the Conservatives aren't getting very much in return. for that. So I disapprove of all this, and I, you know, do think it's going to misfire. But, I mean, the policy at times, until it all collapsed when the House of Commons defeated it, was plainly to outdo Farage. And that's where the government was rapidly going, competing for his votes in order to gain seats from Labour in the North, terrifying half the Labour Party in the process. But I'm not sure it's going to work.
Both leaderships have deserted the centre ground, and explicitly and quite proudly so. As someone who's often seen as a standard bearer for the centre ground, I mean, do you worry about the collapse of the centre, or
I worry about it a lot. I mean, this is you made it a very cheery evening when you started, and I'm a naturally optimistic, laid-back kind of character. But I mean, really, we ought to be deeply depressed that the system has come where it is. There is still a big centre ground, but I'm not one of those who says, well, really, still politics is fought out of the centre. The anger, the polarisation of opinion is at least as bad amongst the public as it is in Parliament. Parliament accurately really reflects the public mood with polarised views, a lot of anger about, a great deal of protest, and no majority for anything. Angry leavers who think they're in the majority, angry remainers who think they're in the majority, some soft Brexiteers who think they're in the middle, and a whole lot of people who are fed up with the whole thing. And out of this chaos, our traditional two-party system, veteran like me is very used to the centre-right, centre-left, few percentage poll change and income, you know, moderate social democrat Labour to replace one nation Tories running the country. It's miles away from where we are, and it has produced two of the most unlikely candidates for leadership that you could ever have imagined. I mean, if the choice for Prime Minister, I don't think it is the choice for Prime Minister, only choice for Prime Minister, seriously, after the next election, you're likely to have a hung Parliament, I would guess. But, you know, the idea that two parties present as potential Prime Ministers, Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn, if you'd told me that was going to happen 10 years ago, I'd have used the phrase you reminded me of, and that's utterly ridiculous. they are the main party's alternatives for leadership. But it's symptomatic of a lot of other things going wrong. And I'm giving a long answer again, but it's gone wrong in every other Western democracy, as you quite rightly said. Trump, Brexit, Boris Johnson, Marine Le Pen, Salvini, Alternative for Deutschland. I could go on. It's repeated in every other Western democracy. They're not functioning in the way they function for the vast majority of my political life. And there was a very angry mood of protest and dislocation out there. And the old big block of centre-right politicians, big block of centre-left politicians, take in turns when one of them's made a pig's ear and then the others take over. I'm not sure we'll ever go back to that, but it is seriously threatened right now.
Part of how we got here was the Conservative Party's endless desire to talk about Europe, and it was something that you really stood
all
against
my life.
Time and time and time again. Why, and obviously you'll have good friends and colleagues that share these views, what is it about our relationship with Europe that has so animated the Tory Party for so long?
Well, it's dominated my entire political life. I became an activist when I was a student, and so took some time deciding which party would have the privilege of having me as a member, but my time decided I joined the Conservatives, mainly because they were modernising, but because Macmillan had applied to join the European Community. And that divided the party, divided the Labour Party, and it became one of the animating themes of my first career, whole career. My first Parliament, I was in the government whip's office, in the Heath government, helping organise the majority for our joining the European Community. Split us badly. The party had a nervous breakdown. We had to defeat our imperialist wing, led by Enoch Powell, by winning the votes of the Jenkinsites and the pro-Europeans who were defying their party to come over and support us. And it's run through my entire political career. It nearly died out in the late 1980s. The country and the party seemed to settle down. It's the same conflict all the way through. I can bore you by getting even before my own political time. There are those... It was the imperialist wing of my party. There are those who are most comfortable with the role they always saw us in, what it used to be like, Dunkirk spirit, Britain alone, that's the real Britain, and upset by the pace of change in the modern world. And then there are those who happen to be thriving and doing quite well in the modern world, globalised economy, smaller political world, you know, they love it. There are lots of them in London. And they always gone along with, you know, enhancing our role in the world by being one of the leaders in the European bloc and joining in a modern free trade globalised economy. And it's a huge gulf. And I was old enough to remember the big controversy when I was an activist student was my great hero Ian MacLeod was giving away the empire. Britain's role was being sacrificed to people who weren't ready for it. We were betraying our kith and kin, led by Smithy in southern Rhodesia, and things that nobody here... The British have expunged all this from their memory. The same bitter battle went on. My hero, Ian MacLeod, who did all that, gave independence to all these African countries that we could not afford to maintain our military presence or anything else in. Was sent to Coventry personally by half the Conservative Party because he was giving the empire away. And that it moved on to become a resistance to this anyway getting associated closely and integrating our economy with the people we'd fought in the war. You know, the British no longer learn any history about the empire or the Commonwealth. That's all expunged from our memory. The British have a curiously British memory of the Second World War, particularly the older generation. And that feeds through to Britain proud and alone and not getting mixed up with these continental things. These are the underlying big things, I think. And those who hate the pace of change and think it used to be better, and those who like the pace of change, not surprisingly, they tend to be the younger, the better educated, the enterprising and so on, who just think Britain's got to play its role in the modern world. And I'm untypical of my generation. I've stuck in the second for some reason. That, as you've done, and the Labour Party's gone through a slightly parallel thing. The left of the Labour Party, nowadays the Corbynistas, they're always reactionary. They're just against change. There was a golden era in the late 1940s from which we should never depart. I remember that's a tedious time of shortages and everything else and the grey bureaucratic phase in our history. Very important things were done. But you know, the left always resists change. The Jenkinsites, today's social democrats, they don't reject the modern world. They too want to move on with it. That underlies the whole thing. I don't remember since Suez, which influenced me in my formative days when I was a politically addicted sixth former, I don't remember the public having blazed apart into angry warring camps as much as they have again now. So there we are. That's a rather abstract interpretation. Gets us away from the crackpot events of day to day at the moment. but that underlines it all. Yeah, absolutely underlines it all. Those people who would feel happier if we were entirely on our own, back running our own affairs, and somehow detached and a bit switched off from what is becoming a frightening pace of change, which includes the old industrial white working class of the North, the Labour equivalent, and those who can't think we've got to live with this. It's the modern world, for God's sake. What on earth are we going into isolation for? Why on earth are we putting new trade barriers between ourselves and Europe and all the rest of it? Can't we do quite well? Aren't we doing quite well already in the single market, which it was British governments that created anyway in the first place?
You talk with fondness about the Jenkinsites, and in your book you talk with fondness about Shelley Williams and Tony Crossland. Is it fair to say that had you been born maybe 5 years later or 5 years earlier, you might have, because you joined the Labour Club at university and joined the other clubs. But
I joined the lot at first.
then, but you could have been a Labour politician.
But it could be, but the Labour Party, well, as I say, it was reactionary. Even that great man, Gaitskill, was reactionary. And the Conservative Party, practically all the active politicians, the ones who went into politics, uniquely probably from my time at university, we all went to the Conservative Party. Because the Conservative Party were the modernisers. It was Rab Butler, really. But it had Macmillan, who was a wily old so-and-so, and MacLeod and Maudling and Heath. And there was this cause. The cause was modernising Britain. But Heath was the leading advocate, at the instructions of Macmillan, who was equally keen, of moving to become a European power. It was a political venture. It was all to make clear it was political, to actually give us a role in the world, which worked. We were one of the three leading big powers in the European bloc, and of the three, we were the one with the closest links with America. And that gave us, at the time of Suez, we'd been a laughing stock, absolute laughing stock. Our foreign policy was to, because of our role in the world, running a canal and occupying a strip of Egyptian territory, we had a right to defend our route to India, which, empire, old boy, it was called the Commonwealth nowadays, but we were very important, we kept our route to India. And an abortive, ludicrous, go-it-alone military arrangement changed the minds of a lot of people like me. Now, the Labour Party was on the wrong side. The Labour Party was only the Jenkinsites, pro-European. Never forget, the Labour Party then fell into the hands of people who became increasingly anti-European, left-wing, and reactionary, in my opinion. It's the Labour Party. There's always been a part of the Labour Party that can't get out of that.
You talk about modernisers. Margaret Thatcher, probably one of the great Tory modernisers, probably the most prominent, certainly post-war. That modernity and modernisation programme, whilst it was definitely modernising, also came at a great price as well. I mean, there must have been periods during the Thatcher period where Britain is at the centre of global events, it is modernising, but there was a price to pay for some of that, perhaps.
There was, which you tried to mitigate. I mean, Margaret was a difficult woman. But the structural reforms that she presided over were necessary, and they were costly. Unfortunately, we have not eliminated the price of it. But the idea, which we might have stuck with, that my county would be full of coal mines in the 21st century was ludicrous, utterly ludicrous. This was a dying industry. The majority of the coal mines in the United Kingdom had been closed before Margaret Thatcher became Prime Minister. If you want to relate to things, it was all under the Wilson government when Alf Robins, a leading Labour politician, was put in charge of the coal board and closed coal mines like there was no tomorrow because it was just a ludicrously over-expensive source of energy for the country, and it's a 19th century industry. And the idea is that it required dramatic change, and it required, in my opinion, market forces with a social conscience. Now, Margaret was all abrasive and aggressive, and we flirted with the worst of... She flirted with the worst of some of the more ultra-libertarian free marketeers and so on, but not really. She did have a social conscience as well, though it wasn't always totally apparent. But they were necessary. Now, we thought we were mitigating the consequences. Every government of my lifetime has had regional policies, industrial regeneration policies, and all the rest of it, which were going to help the places where the change was most erratic turn around. Now, unfortunately, that's tricky, and it's defeated everybody, and that's still coming to place. But the idea that we could have done without the Thatcher reforms, that we could have stayed with... Well, Italy has finally changed, but we could have stayed with all those continental countries that politically were not able to do it, I think would have been disastrous. We were becoming an industrial, an economic laughing stock. She gave us the courage of our convictions. Everybody until Margaret came along and the Conservative Party would have said, well, of course, it would be much better if we didn't have this bureaucratic, state-owned section of the economy, if life was not dominated by the trade unions, and if ministers did not have to spend 90% of their time on industrial relations. But then we would say, if you weren't careful, as my great admirer of people like Jim Pryor always said, oh, you can't do that, it'd upset the trade unions, it's not possible in the real world, old boy. Well, she didn't understand all that, so she gave us all the courage of our convictions, and, well, it was, you know, pretty lively the whole damn time. The changes were desirable, mitigating the consequences of a world where the economy is changing at an ever-accelerating rate now has so far proved ever so slightly beyond the range of most politicians. Also true in every Western country. Trump appeals to the left behind in the Rust Belt states and the more difficult rural areas, and those who resent the pace of change want to go back to America, proud, isolationist, alone. I won't go through all the others I listed. It's the same in every case. But the idea, oh, the answer was just to stay stuck in the 1960s, which we're going back 50 years if we leave with no deal. Going back to the 1960s is, in my biased opinion, a total illusion. And to blame all the problems on the fact that Margaret Thatcher made us going for essential structural reforms, idiotic. There are several European countries that I want the people, they need a Margaret Thatcher. You won't lift Italy and Spain, and Spain's doing better, Greece. Ideally, they need a Margaret Thatcher. The trouble is, only in extreme circumstances will an electorate ever vote for a Margaret Thatcher, because the electorate on the whole don't like, most of the electorate don't like change. They usually, when you have a policy that involves radical change, the public are always against it.
In terms of your relationship with Margaret Thatcher, did it change during that period of her leadership, and would she seek counsel from you, even though towards the end, perhaps, that distance was slightly marked?
Well, she ran a cabinet government. So did John Major. It's practically extinct now. I don't think the present cabinet's allowed to talk about anything. but that's been growing since Blair, really, since they started it, but it gets worse and worse. She ran a collective government. People are very surprised to hear that, but all the policies had to have the approval of cabinet. The cabinet would agree policies in cabinet committees and then resolve them. We had much cabinet sat for long times, you know, a whole morning every week. In Heath's day, it was two mornings a week, but we sometimes went over on when it got a lot on. And that was to try to get cabinet consent to policies. And Margaret, you know, was in the minority sometimes. She didn't like being in the minority. She spoke for 50% of the time, and she always started discussions where we make it quite clear what she thought we all should agree to. But I saw her lose arguments, sometimes with rather bad grace. I persuaded her to change her mind on things. You had one-to-one rows with her sometimes if, as a cabinet minister, you wanted to bring things forward and it wasn't as she wanted. And the great thing about arguing with Margaret, which you had to remind yourself afterwards sometimes, was the only thing you were arguing about was what is in the public interest, what is the right thing to do. If you remember the phrase, it was conviction politics. She never read newspapers. The idea the opinion polls were against you didn't interest her. We never had a major policy which was ahead in the opinion polls. I never implemented, and I was with her all the way through, shadow and minister, then cabinet for a long time. I never had a policy to implement which the most of the public agreed with. But what we did was, politicians are meant to have views on the national interest. You're trying to make a bit of a difference to the good. You do what you think is right, and then you argue the toss about it, and you try to persuade people why you're doing it, and you all the rest of it. You've got to do it in the first half of a parliament, because with any luck, if it starts to work properly, if you haven't made a pig's ear, the public change their view and they start changing their mind. So the Thatcher government, every term, was hugely unpopular in my mid-term. The first session, we dropped down to about 18% in the polls, I think. The Labour Party split in two and both halves of it were ahead of us. That's true. That's absolutely literally true. We got elected. Then you turned your attention to getting another term and having a go at getting in. Well, there couldn't be a greater contrast with politics nowadays, which increasingly over the last 15 years has been, can we get good headlines next Tuesday in the Daily Telegraph? That is what it's all aimed at now. And opinion polls are all over the place. You know, you can't possibly run a country on opinion polls. You're meant to have political skills you're elected to implement what you believe to be in the public interest, defend it, argue for it, and with any luck, and the initial reaction's over, public will start coming through. I mean, eventually, when Blair brought the Labour Party back to power, he made no attempt to reverse any of the Thatcher reforms, and indeed, my health reforms, Ken Baker's education reforms, were taken up with enthusiasm, were taken much further than Ken and I could ever dare hoped we could get away with. And that was the Thatcher government.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping. And that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Describing government in that way, it sounds very attractive, particularly now. But you have to have some idea of public opinion. And poll tax proved that it was a policy was. She was
that's when she lost. That's when she lost it. Yeah. The trouble with the poll tax, it was totally impractical. Should be a maximum permitted dose for leadership of a party. 10 years is the maximum. It's bound to end in tears if you just go on forever. And she did begin. She'd reached a stage where she was no longer. The collective stuff was going. I mean, she was going by the seat of her pants. The days when her judgment usually in the end coincided with what went right, she was losing all that. And she got obsessed with the wretched poll tax, which was a crazy policy, and ploughed on with it. But she was getting, you know, you wear out, I'd say, 10 years is the maximum permitted dose, really. That after that, it's almost impossible not to have made so many enemies and beginning to get off the rails. It's time for somebody else to have a go. So she did lose it in the end. You know.
Do you think Boris will do 10 years?
But the poll tax has never... Well, he might amaze us all, you know. going back to history, the most unlikely people have, in the end, done quite well. But Boris's approach is very different to Margaret's, so I think it doesn't resemble it. Absolutely. He could be a very short-lived Prime Minister.
When you think about the two big kind of rows of the Thatcher era, the miners' strike and the poll tax, you're an MP in Nottinghamshire, which affected by the miners' strike, an area deeply affected by the poll tax. I mean, you were going to watch Nottingham Forest and Notts County, and still do go and watch them.
Always have, yeah.
Football in that period was, football grounds were far more robust places than they are.
Well, we had that phase of football violence. Yeah.
Did you get involved? Michigan.
No, you had to try dodging it. That was the thing. I mean, trying to avoid it, I used to take my children to football matches, and you did have to be careful where you went and all this kind of thing. It's because it became at times, it got quite fixated, football violence.
But did you get any abuse from fans? Did you ever worry about going to football matches in that period?
Not for political abuse, no. No, I didn't ever get that. But I mean, just the fact that if you've got kids with you, you just have to make sure. I did once find myself with my daughter and one of her friends between two warring camps. That was actually not at Nottingham, that was Aston Villa. I can't remember who the other team were, but there was a gang, large numbers from both sides, preparing to have a punch up. And I'd accidentally wandered between the two sides. But because I got the two kids with me, they let us go through before they got into the real entertainment for the afternoon, as far as they were concerned. And my strike is more serious. That was the worst social crisis of my lifetime, the Midas strike. That did bring things to a head, and was the cultural implications of all that were quite important. That was a real moment of social tension, very divisive, and in Nottingham, very apparent, even in my own constituency, because we had working miners, and pickets poured in to Nottinghamshire, and were defended by police who were poured in, and I went to Mansfield at one time during the strike, and I went through a police checkpoint, you know, before I could get in doing a political meeting. In my own constituency, I had one pit left before the strike at Cotgrave. Miners from Kent were coming up and doing the picketing, because that was a very militant area, Kent. Policemen came from Essex to control it. And they occasionally had the odd punch-up in the main street of the village. All my constituents went to work over the fields around the back, and the pit carried on working as normal. But the underlying tensions, including the old, they were being roused, the old class tensions, the old regional tensions, and above all, the tensions between the politically... I'm getting into bias now, but it was very politically motivated, hardcore left of the trade union movement, and the government. It was a critical time, which I personally think, obviously the country came through it and we healed ourselves from that. The present tensions are different, but these tensions are going to take a few years to get out of, I think.
We're both supporters of Nottingham Forest, and we shouldn't indulge that in certainly not outside of Nottingham. But Forest, obviously managed for a long time by Brian Clough, who... I gather you had a friendship with, you know,
I knew him quite well. Yeah, I mean, he wasn't a great mate or anything, but the two of us knew each other quite well, because he was quite political.
Well, he was a very left wing.
I mean, you probably know the stories I always tell about Brian, if you're thinking me on, because you read my book. But I think I put him in there, I can't remember what I put in the book. he was quite left wing, he was offered the Labour candidature at Loughborough. Very wisely turned it down. He would have been a disastrous member of Parliament. He was tempted. But he went for a phase at one point of leading demos outside my Saturday morning surgeries. And the same people every week, but with a different banner every week, a different cause, would go marching past, shouting and all the rest of it, and cheering and all the rest. And I did have a conversation with him, got him out of it. I said, firstly, you know, could you knock it off, Brian? Because you're frightening some of the old ladies who come to see me, and we can't hear what the hell we're talking about inside. And anyway, at the moment, you know, your football club is doing no better than my government, and I shall start getting together a demo before the matches, before I come into the ground in the afternoon. Anyway, I joked and talked him out of it. And the other thing I used to do with Brian was, he always made a mess of buying overseas players when we became a big European club. And things like getting visas and, you know, work permits and all that. So, particularly when I was Home Secretary, I get a funny call from Brian. could I sort out this or that and get a player in? But that meant I got to know him a bit. He was a remarkable football manager. Any fool can win trophies managing Arsenal or Manchester United or that. But to take a, you know, bog-standard Midland team, and even in those days, and the teams, you know, could sometimes second division, have a few years in the first division and go back again, going back to the old divisions, to take Derby County to the first division championship, fall out with them, and at Beesburn and Leeds get picked up by us and take Nottingham Forest to the First Division Championship, and then to win two European Cups with Nottingham Forest. There is no football manager rival that at all. And it was in the most distinctive way, you know. It was all drinking, effing, blinding, getting players who everybody, other clubs were anxious to get out of the dressing room so he didn't have to pay a big transfer fee because we got no money. It was a quite remarkable performance.
I think we can all agree it's the best thing that ever happened.
you, like me, come from Nottingham. Again, what I try to avoid in politics, you're getting me, you're quite the wrong influence this evening. they are becoming a football club that lives in the past, you know, all the clubs. That, oh, we remember our great days. And if we're not careful, in 100 years' time, you know, anguished Nottingham Forest supporters will be saying, you know, you remember the great days of Brian Clough and all that. But who knows, who might get back. You weren't at the Emirates last night.
No, I wasn't, no.
We kept Arsenal down to 5-0, you know. We're not back to beating Brian Clough yet. It's not happened.
I remember that period, so not the glory years, I wasn't born, but I remember you opening...
You weren't born?
I was born in 1982. So I remember later successes.
I should stop going on about these historic times.
But I remember you opening the new stand in, I think, 1992, the Bridgford stand. And what I remember about that period is Clough still managing Forest. John Major's the prime minister. That year, 1992, starts the season where Forest get relegated. It's also the year that John Major scores this incredible victory, really, against Neil Kinnock. And it's the first real political memory that I have is the 92 election. And really, even as a kid, thinking, oh, well, Kinnock's going to win this. I mean, at the...
As everybody thought.
Yeah, and did you think he was going to win?
Well, I think the world thought he was going to win, that Kinnock was going to win. That was John Major's highlight. That was John Major's highlight. And John was a good Prime Minister, but and I'd probably annoy him by always saying Thatcher was the best Prime Minister I ever worked for, leaving aside all the problems. John's a great mate of mine. But the achievement of the Major government, really, historic achievement, was to consolidate the Thatcher structural reforms. Now, that 1992 government, we were going to lose. I thought we were going to lose. Anybody who knew anything about politics thought we were going to lose. And if you remember, if you obviously were old enough then to remember the campaign, it was very much John Major with this weird thing of getting an old soapbox out
yes.
and doing appearances. And it was Thatcherism with a human face. And he came across as the which he is, as a thoroughly decent, nice guy. You know, great achievements to his name, to ever become a Prime Minister as he had. The left helped him enormously by turning up and barracking him, so he was always surrounded by the worst elements of the Labour Party shrieking and shouting at him, which fed the message. And it was rather a personal election win. And we carried on the agenda, but with more of a social conscience, slightly more restrained, but we consolidated things. And the 1992 defeat had a shattering effect on the Labour Party. Kinnock had made a great achievement in modernising the Labour Party and making it electable again, but it hadn't quite got there. And I think it was John Smith by then. Was it Smith by then?
After 92, yeah.
He was after, yeah, so it was Kinnock. But he would have felt obliged to start reversing half the Thatcher things. The movement was still devoted to repealing the trade union laws and all this. When they got over being shattered by the fact they'd lost the election, I mean, most of the Labour politicians I knew could not believe they'd lost again. I mean, people begin to say, can the Labour Party ever win an election ever again? Because they've been out for so long. Blair, Mandelson, Brown actually decided the party had got to change. They weren't going to reverse the Thatcher reforms. They had to come to terms with the Thatcher reforms. They had to turn the Labour Party into a social democrat party that was looking forward and didn't want a rerun of the miners' strike or whatever to get revenge on the other side. That's how, helped by our Eurosceptics, Blair won power so convincingly in 1997. And he brought in the Labour Party, totally new Labour Party, as I've already said, made absolutely no attempt whatever to reverse any of the structural reforms. And that was the major government's achievement. And the Corbynistas now hate the Blairites far more than they hate Tories. They're in as Tories, but they're trying to reverse that. And if I was a Labour man, I would obviously be one of those who would think that's a historic, disastrous mistake. If the Labour Party had a Social Democrat leader now, they'd be 30% ahead in the polls and onto a walkover.
I remember you getting involved in a campaign called Britain in Europe early on in that New Labour period, and it was you and Mike Russell time. I think it was Paddy Ashdown and Charles Kennedy, Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. They did these cross parties. I went to one in Nottingham.
Michael and I, Heather and I, appeared on a platform with Tony Blair and a rather more reluctant Gordon Brown, who sat there and sulked there all the way through. Yes. Didn't lie. It was making a message.
Campaign would have continued and we'd have had a...
Well, it has, really.
But imagine if it had been an organised cross-party, pro-European drumbeat that successive leaderships would have signed up to. We might not have voted to leave.
Well, trying to get cross-party things going now. Yes, the campaign's all run into the ground, but it was part of the same thing. Yeah, the nearest we got to getting rid of this European divide, which I won't repeat, I think is symbolic of a lot of other things, it's why it persists, was the late 1980s. For a time, in the late 1980s, in the country was settling down to the European Union, and I think it would have settled down irreversibly. If you want me to go in for mad theories again, the fall of Margaret Thatcher is caused to go backwards. The people who surrounded Margaret after she, in the bitterness of being defeated and when she retired, persuaded her it was all a European plot that had brought her down, and revenge for Margaret Thatcher was the driving motive that put the Maastricht rebels together again, and it all flared up again, and the Tory parties never got rid of it, and nor has the Labour Party, really. You've still got Michael Foot and the Eurosceptics fighting the Jenkinsites, and both parties have got mad coalitions, constitutions for their parties when it comes to electing leaders. So in both parties, there's a pro-European Conservative majority, there's a pro-European Social Democrat majority in the Parliamentary Labour Party, and at the moment both parties are being led by the anti-European right and the anti-European left.
I mean, those structures and those constitutions are something that you have painful personal experience of in 97, 01 and 05. And what I really remember about that period was I was very much a supporter of New Labour, and thinking, well, obviously the Tories have got to pick Ken Clark if they want to win. And just everyone I spoke to, even Conservative
friends... I think that was Tony Blair's view. But that's my being arrogant, that I don't know. But, yeah, well, I can't blame the system. It was fashionable in the 1990s to say the members decide the leadership. I actually think the sensible system is for MPs to decide the leadership because they know the candidates intimately well, and they're the ones who've got to actually fall in behind the leadership of the winner and organise the campaigning and the parliamentary activity that gets them to power if they can. But it was fashionable in the 1990s to go for this democracy, and both parties have now gone to giving votes to anybody who pays a subscription, which attracts activists who don't really represent the broad vote that they have outside. So I can't complain too much because I've lost so often. I lost by both systems. I lost to the MPs one only, to William Hague, and then I lost to the membership a couple of times. So I was too pro-European is my defence. That was the thing. And all my supporters always urged me to make a Eurosceptic speech to calm it down and to modify it, which I thought would just get me laughed at. Anyway, I didn't want to be Prime Minister pretending that I agreed with policies that I thought were utterly unacceptable. So, but anyway, I'm not lamenting. Probably I had a much better life if I'm getting out of it. But that's the system is now part of the system, because I mean, if you half the Labour Party don't want an election at the moment because they dread the idea of Jeremy Corbyn becoming Prime Minister. And so do the vast bulk of the public. And I say the Labour Party would be onto a walkover if they could only get rid of Jeremy. It is the current position.
The last time you stood for the leadership was 2005. That was the leadership contest that David Cameron won, eventually against David Davis. How would, apart from probably not having a referendum on whether to leave the European Union or not, how would a Ken Clark government from 2010 onwards been different to the Cameron government that we had?
Well, and the Cameron government was not bad, actually. It was a very good coalition government. If I'd been in coalition, I doubt that it would change much. I mean, the coalition worked very well. Lib Dems were quite good, were good coalition partners. They were a perfectly reasonable lot. And divisions within the government and arguments about things weren't even on party lines, actually. You know, when we did disagree and had to come to some conclusions to how we were proceeding, often you'd have Liberals and Conservatives on one side and Liberals and Conservatives on the other. I'm a combative, reforming sort of bloke, an activist sort of bloke, which is no doubt one of my weaknesses. So I don't know. We probably have, I've probably gone in for some, again, carried on my every department I ever had. I had to have some agenda. I had to be changing something for what I thought was a worthwhile difference. That's a bit more of that, but I don't think there's anything wrong with Cameron's record. Apart from the one obvious blemish, which will damage his historical reputation irreversibly, that this reckless, sort of irresponsible decision to hold a referendum. And Tony's the same. Tony Blair ran a pretty good government, really. But there was one awful, terrible mistake.
Super
Iraq. Iraq. And he'll never get rid of that in his historic reputation. And I defied the Tory whip and Ian Duncan Smith, our leader, and all that by being the most vociferous Conservative against the invasion of Iraq. So, but anyway, otherwise I'm not sure the tone of the government, I hope, if I'd led it, would have been very similar. Actually, looking back, that last time I stood, it was a very good idea that I lost in the sense that the decision taken was very sensible. Skip a generation, get away from all the old arguments. I had far too much baggage. I might have won that last time, except my votes were all taken by Cameron. And people who I always thought were going to vote for the Parliamentary Party, suddenly, you could tell they were suddenly saying they're going to vote for Cameron, because Cameron was saying the right, modernising, one nation, Tory things. He had absolutely no backstory. He was not associated with the battles of Maastricht, and he hadn't been around arguing with trade unions years ago and all that. Turn over a page, and he made the Conservative Party electable again. We'd gone through 10 years having right-wing leaders who couldn't have won an election if they'd gone on for 1,000 years, and he made us electable again. And he carried on in coalition, helped by the fact the Liberals were a good influence on the cabinet, helped by the fact he was in coalition to run a pretty good, stable government. I was served in the guy, followed him 4 years. It was pretty good. But towards the end, I did have a damn great row with him when I read in the newspapers he was going to promise this wretched referendum. And as we see, as he's publishing his book, trying to defend himself over that is dominating the political discussions around the publication of his book, and it's inevitable. I can't imagine myself how, with hindsight, it's ever going to look as though that was a responsible thing to have done.
You mentioned defying the whip. You've now had the whip removed, which is just incredible as a view of politics. Ken Clark has had the Conservative whip removed. So,
well, Heza had hit the whip removed in the House of Lords about 2 months ago.
But he's just...
And I've joined him. I mean, John Major would have the whip removed if he had one, but he's not going to the Lords.
You're still a Conservative member. You're still a Conservative member of
Parliament. I'm still a Conservative. It makes not the slightest practical difference to me. I mean, nothing has changed whatever. The Conservative Party is still operating in the same way in the House of Commons. I sit where I used to sit, and I eat with all my colleagues, and there's no personal animosity at all. Carry on exactly as I did before. I will tend, depending how long that's, to vote Conservative, except on Europe, which has been going on some time, ever since we got into this current mode on Europe. And so I've long ago announced I wasn't going to stand at the election. So I'm just bemused, slightly amused. I apparently am a member of the Conservative Party. I had a conversation, friendly one, and just bumped into the corner. I know quite well. James Cleverly and I weren't quite sure whether I was still a member of the Conservative Party. And was he still my chairman? But he checked it. Yes, I am. I'm still a member of the Conservative Party. I've just lost the whip. So, I am angry on behalf of my younger colleagues. I'm not. The ones that were pursuing were in midterms with very good political careers, who, if we don't find a way of getting out of this nonsense in the next 2 or 3 weeks, there's going to be rows about them being candidates in the forthcoming election. That is very serious. Somebody like me, frankly, I couldn't care less. It doesn't make the slightest difference to anything I do or plan. Even I have finally realised that the time has come to pack it in. All my friends are very kindly and politely urging me not to and to stand. But anyway, losing the Conservative whip is... nobody told me. I read in the newspapers. I gather I have lost the whip. But it's no practical difference to me. It's a very important practical difference to some of the 21. And I shall regret it if some very good people... taken out of the party or taken out of politics, because I'm sure they never imagined that 21 were going to lose the whip. Having got themselves into this mess, I trust Downing Street and the whip's office are trying to think of some face-saving way of getting out of it and giving the whip back. If there's an ounce of common sense left in Downing Street, that is obviously what they should be doing.
Okay, let's take some questions from the audience. If you indicate clearly a question you'd like to ask Ken, we'll get a roving mic over to you. And if we can ask for one sentence questions and one sentence answers, Ken, and we
that's what all television interviewers say to me before it starts.
The gentleman over on the far side.
I'll try,
And I'll try and get three or four in. But if you could pass the microphone down quickly, let us know your name and a quick question. And here we go.
Hi, my name's Dan. Only question for Ken is, when did you first come across Nigel Farage and what was your immediate impression?
I met him a few times, appearing on television with him, on Question Time and things like that. I get on very well with him. He's with the two of us. I've never fallen out with anybody, personally, over their political opinions. And we've had quite amusing conversations and things. I don't think we'd ever be good, close personal friends, because we're very different personalities, but we get on perfectly reasonably, and I have no objection to him. I think he has quite a different style of campaigning to me or anybody else, but he's a brilliant campaigner, appealing to the audience he's appealing to. He's very shrewd. He's got his head screwed on the right way. I suspect he was a rather canny commodity trader in the city when he used to do that. And he's achieved extraordinary success simply because he latches on to the mood of the times, which I dilated on extensively a little time ago. But now I have to admit, much though I regret it, because what he campaigns for is fundamentally against one of my most deeply held political convictions, I don't underestimate him. That's why I think if the party crashes on with this mad policy of trying to win older, white, working class votes in Leave voting constituencies in the north of England, they're up against it. Not just the Labour Party, they've got Nigel to take on. and he knows what he's doing. I bet one is entourage in a curry house in London. And I've met him before. I met him with Nigel, so I had a long chat with him, and the two of us appraised the present political situation in a very similar way. I think they're quite confident that you know, things they could make a difference. They're not going to form a government or anything, but they could make a difference if we crash into an early election on the present basis. But I have no reason. I have no reason to have any ill feelings towards Nigel Farage. I've got on personally very well. We once were on a Question Time together on television, and we both got booed by the audience. I remember what this issue was now. The two of us had answered some completely non-European question, and by happy coincidence, we took an identical view, which was plainly against the majority, contrary to the majority of what are nowadays the very noisy Question Time audiences you have. So I had the intriguing thing, as did he, of sitting there being booed by large sections of the audience for agreeing with Nigel Farage and he vice versa. Can't remember where it was now.
Is there anyone here that would like to ask a question? Yes, the lady at the back.
You talked a little bit about Thatcher busting the unions and how that was necessary to modernising the economy, which I, to be clear, do not disagree with. But I guess a lot of people would now trace that back to breaking worker power. And actually, looking today, a lot of the economic issues we have are around workers not having a way to be able to make their weight felt, particularly in negotiations. And you can see that a lot with wages and also the kind of contracts that they end up getting involved in. I don't know if you agree with that or if you think there's any particular way forward.
I know there's a direct link. The union power I'm talking about was the extraordinary union power that developed in the 60s and 70s. And before we got elected in 1979, the Thatcher government, that is, there was an opinion poll held about who the most powerful people were in the country, and it was a guy called Jack Jones, another called Hugh Scargill. The public saw as the most powerful people in the country, and a lot of politicians agreed with that. And there were a lot of Conservatives very cautious about union reforms, again, Jim Pryor, because you couldn't annoy the unions. The public would back the unions. The public always backed the unions, and they always backed strikes. And it would become absolutely overwhelming. If you were a business leader, I was told at the time, I wasn't one, certainly if you were a minister, as I was, a high proportion of your working day was supposed to be spent on industrial relations. One of the things I tried to break from in health was to actually have a look at the system and delivery of healthcare. The job was supposed to be conducting and getting a reasonable settlement of this year's pay claim for the highly industrialised workforce of the British Labour, and the idea that patient outcomes should rank above an agreement on the pay terms and conditions of the members was regarded as unthinkable. I'm not exaggerating. I'm slightly even colouring it with my argument, not a great deal. And that had been broken. And Scargill and the coal mines, that was what decided. That was the decisive event. That was the end of the old 1960s union power. And Scargill had got rid of one government. The strike was called in order to get rid of the government. That's what it was about. The cause he was allegedly fighting was ludicrous, that no coal mine should ever be closed in future until all its reserves had been worked out. Communist Czechoslovakia couldn't run its coal mines like that. It was in order to get rid of the Thatcher government. He got rid of the Heath government, and he now called a strike to get rid of a second one. And that was the final Waterloo of what had been a long battle for 10, 15 years. Now, it is true, the world is now totally transformed, and a tiny proportion of the workforce in the private sector now have any organisation. And one of the problems of the last 20 years is the successful in the new economy are very successful, and a large part of the population like the new digital, modern, high-tech economy. About half the population are stuck still, doing nothing for them, no jobs for their kids, and their town's been left behind. And amongst other things, there's not much union representation. That is, I think, caused by the type of economy we developed. Hasn't just happened here, it's happened in America, happened in most other countries, and as you go into today's economy as opposed to the old heavy industrial economies of my youth, then trade union organisations got to be different. It doesn't always work. The whole sections where you can't get union power anyway. As I said earlier, I think we've all collectively not quite sure what to do about this left behind feeling, which is what gives rise to protest, extremist politics, angry anti-establishment feelings, rejections of politicians as a whole class, and an attraction for powerful, usually male, apart from Madame Le Pen, machismo figures with simple solutions who can identify scapegoats, foreigners usually, who are responsible for your state of affairs. And something between the old abuse of union power, which we broke, and today's populist, nationalist protests has got to be found. And it'd be nice to have something which ran capitalism and free markets on a basis which was perceived to distribute the benefits fairer. But you can't go back from where we are now and have somebody like Arthur Scargill back again. There's got to be some happy compromise, which I suppose is just the story of my life. I usually wind up arguing for the happy compromise in most things, believe it or not, despite the combative style I sometimes adopt in trying to get it.
Okay, we've got time for one last question.
I haven't given you this one sentence answer.
Let's see if we can now. Just keep your hand up because the microphone's coming to you so that Jules can see you. Let us know your name and obviously final and therefore best question of the night.
I'm Lucy. I'd really like to know what you think about Joe Swinson.
About who?
Joe Swinson, the leader of the Liberal Democrats.
Oh, Joe, yeah, I like him. You want me to answer that seriously? She's very nice, she's very bright. I like her. I would have voted for Ed Davey. He's another Nottingham man. But the jury's out on Joe. I mean, I wait to see. I can't. I mean, I'm not a Liberal Democrat. But the great opportunity of the Liberal Democrats, whatever the Liberal Democrats surge, they're the vehicle for protest votes. And so she's suddenly presented with a great opportunity because there are a lot of protest votes about from right and left. Now, so she's got lots of qualities. She's good, bright, intelligent, honest, and, well, you know, motivated is fine, all rest of it. I like her. And she's very articulate. My reservation is, can I see Joe becoming a national political figure? I'm not sure. She could suffer the fate of Tim Farron, who's a perfectly decent guy, perfectly all right. And, you know, but Tim was never going to make any great mark on the national stage. He just doesn't have the personality and the, what you no doubt need to a certain extent, eccentric personal style to make a mark as a political campaigner. Now, is Jo just going to be a very nice woman who happens to be the leader of the Liberal Party whilst they're in protest? Well, I think the jury's out. I, you know, raised my eyebrows at this Liberal Assembly, but I can see the arguments for taking a rather bold, possibly reckless, but only with hindsight will you know whether it'll be dismissed as reckless or courageous, and so on. You never know. So that's a non-answer to the last question. Isn't possibly the, might be the shortest I've given, but it's not a very competitive field. I wait to see what Joe Swinson's like, but I'm not. I rather welcome her arrival on the scene, much though I'd have liked my mate Ed to have been given a go instead. But I'm not a Liberal Democrat, so that had nothing to do with me.
Ken, it's been an absolute pleasure. We'll be back at the end of next month, where I can almost confirm the guest, but not yet. And the Christmas special is on sale at the Bloomsbury Theatre at the end of December. Check the Twitter feed at Matt Ford for future guests. I have some very exciting guests that are confirmed, but not yet announced for future dates, so watch this space. But ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to be back. But please give a huge thank you to one of the greatest guests we've ever had here, potentially our next Prime Minister, Ken Clark.
Well, there you go, Ken Clark. What an absolute hero in so many ways. Even the things I disagreed with him on. It's amazing as well just how he's still Ken Clark. And I know that sounds like such a silly thing to say, but he's not diminished by time at all. He's still full of beans, still got that brilliant, booming voice. He's got a great voice to listen to. And still funny. His wisdom is undimmed. His memory is crystal clear. His analysis is great. My word. One of those people you have to slightly pinch yourself afterwards that you've actually met. A quality, it feels like, from a completely different time now. And that's not really saying much, because obviously politics has become far more chaotic in the last 3 or 4 years, but he really feels like particularly a conservative from a different era. And even though, I was never a conservative, the one thing I've always respected about the party is people like Ken Clark and Dominic Grieve and the people who believe in a sense of, it's not even just about dignity, but the rules matter. And the rules are there for a reason. And there's a kind of there's an inherent respect for democracy and parliament contained within that. And you can tell that he, and like Dominic Grieve and others, are agitated by this period, not just because they disagree with Brexit, but because the way in which it is being conducted offends them as conservatives. It contradicts what they believe conservatives are, I think. So it's just, oh man, he was great. And talking to him about Forest, obviously, just, although the Clough stories were great, so I don't believe that was too self-indulgent. But you can email the show, politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com, and let me know what you thought. I have to say, it's been a real pleasure of late to have had so many emails. I always get quite a few. In the last few weeks, there have been far more, so I don't know whether this is Brexit-related or whatever. But James East got in touch. He says, I've begun to listen to the back catalogue of your podcast in the last several days. I do get quite a few emails from people saying that because they've heard an interview elsewhere, they weren't aware of the show, and then they just binge on the whole thing. A friend of mine did this recently, so I was getting texts about the Charles Clark episode or the Alistair Campbell episodes, which is great fun because obviously I don't go back and listen to them, so I've no idea whether we'll have made fools out of ourselves in making predictions about the future. But James East says he's a Conservative Party member, more or less since David Cameron's rise to power, 46 years old. I run the family timber business in somewhat difficult times. I cannot fully express how disappointed I am in Cameron's successes and how little the current party resembles something that I feel I could vote for. He says, however, I take hope and comfort from your guests. By now, Rory Stewart is a busted flush, although I hope not, but both he and Sam Ghima are brilliant and articulate and eminently electable. Well, Sam Ghima, of course, now a Liberal Democrat, James, so I wonder if that means that you'll be voting Lib Dem for the first time in your life. We'll see. James Silcox gets in touch about the Darren Grimes episode. Now, I had loads of tweets about the Darren Grimes episode, broadly falling into two camps, and I'm sure you can imagine what those two camps were. But he says, this was the episode where my expectations were most dramatically proven to be incorrect. I'd never heard or seen Darren speak before. I'd only really read about him in news articles, and from this I expected him to have a degree of youthful self-righteousness and arrogance, perhaps with a similar personality to, and he mentioned someone else who it wouldn't be fair for me to name, so let's forget that bit. He says, like you, I voted Remain, and I disagree with Darren's views on the EU, but it was still really interesting to hear his background story and to hear him express his vulnerabilities in a very human way. So thank you very much, James in Lincolnshire. James, I felt exactly the same way about Darren. I don't share his politics around Brexit, but I've had him on the show because I've been fascinated by him. And for me, as I said last week, it was one of the most enjoyable ones I've ever done. Harold gets in touch and says, thank you for the podcast. I listen to it while fixing copiers or driving from customer to customer here in Norway. Amazing. Harold, thank you so much. A Norway deal has been found through this podcast. Also, Ross gets in touch to say he listens in Japan, and not just in Japan, but while hiking through the mountains of Japan. Well, I mean, if you can beat that, do email politicalpartypodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for all your emails. Of course, I can't read them all out. But it's always just lovely to hear what your favourite episodes are, where you listen, how you got into it, and any recommendations for guests. I've had some fantastic suggestions from guests, from listeners that I've already started to pursue. So hopefully I can make your dream come true. And don't forget, you can get tickets to those London shows, the Christmas party special. By the way, the political party at the Other Palace does sell out quite a way in advance, but there are still tickets left for some of the later ones next year. You can go to the website otherpalace.co.uk. The Christmas party special on the 18th of December is now on sale. The ticket link for that is in the show notes. And my solo show, Brexit Pursued by a Bear, which enjoyed a wonderful run at this year's Edinburgh Festival, is now being brought to London. So you can come and see it at King's Place on the 12th of October, or before that, the 6th of October at the South Bank Centre. And as I said before, the links to those tickets are in the show notes right here. So thank you so much for listening to this. If you could leave a review on iTunes, it really does help so many more people find the show and listen to it. And if you could just share it with a friend, put it on your Facebook, on your Instagram, on your Twitter when the show comes out, it just helps people find it. So thank you. See you soon. Ta-ra.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.